Accession number 10165, reel number 46.
Martin McLean, reel 46. You were describing the positions you'd taken up on the low hill in front of Kohima.
Yes. They had occupied this position. It was like a flat on top of a hill. And they had used the rough ground. It's something like a crater of a volcano, let's put it that way. There seemed to be ridges right round the top of the hill. Maybe they tried to make it into a paddy field, the Indians. I don't know what, but this is for crops and things of that nature. And the troops are using the high ground in front of this plateau for revetments, for the shoot-up, whatever it was. But I considered if three-inch mortars or artillery had ranged and hit this hill, we'd had severe casualties. So I made our men dig slit trenches all around where they were standing. Get down under this level. Because if they were down, we wouldn't suffer so many casualties. It so happened that was just a precaution which was unnecessary. We weren't hit. I was talking to an officer of the relieving of the unit we'd just relieved. He was sitting very contemplative, looking over towards the hill where the B Company had done the attack. And he was describing one part of the attack he saw. He says, if I could find who that lad was who fought them Japs in that trench there, he says, I'd put him in for a VC. He says, this is what I saw. He says, one lad on his own, he saw these Japanese and he went at them with his bayonet. He jumped into this trench after them. He killed them. Some Japs got out and he started fighting the Japs that got out. And he killed the lot except one, and they killed him, or they shot him down. He said, if I could find that man's name, I'd put him in for VC. The gallant work he done. But we never did get to know, because I had no means of getting to know. Now we were engaged in battle. We settled into this defensive position because we were told to stay there that night, to just let this unit out. And they scarpered off, as I said, glad to get away, to get something to eat, to get changed, to be looked after for a change instead of suffering the way they had been. We were in this position next morning. Let's go back to the night. I'm getting a bit off track a bit there. During the night, we were now looking up at Kohima. We could see all the fighting that was going on there during the night. The flares, the shells landing, the flurry of weaponry, Bren guns firing, rifles firing, Japanese guns firing. There was a rare battle going on up there. And we could do nothing at all about it to help them. Now, the Royal West Kents were in there, not us.
Where were the Indians? The Indians had relieved the town then, not the hill.
They'd be in there. There was no town. There's no town such as a town. There were just a few huts. But the Indians would be in some place there. I don't know where they'd been put, but they were in there as well.
But they were still being hard-pressed by the Japanese.
Very, very hard-pressed. The Japs were trying to push them off. The Royal West Kents hadn't come out, nor had the Burma levies, as they called them, and the other troops, the Indian administration troops, hadn't come out. So they're still surrounded. And we were watching this fight all night, and nothing we could do. But next morning, we're told Royal Berks is going in. So the Royal Berks marched past us. And, you know, they were always in our brigade. Good luck, lads. Good luck. As the march passed, we had to stay here because it was apparently an important position. I don't know its value. I was only interested in getting into Kohima. The Royal Berks went into Kohima. And in a very short while, you could hear such a furious battle going on. Well, we didn't move forward for another day. And that night, there seemed to be a massive war going on up the front. The Royal Berks were really topping it. We knew the area that had gone into by the district commissioner's bungalow and area. And the one on top of the hill, on a flank of the hill, all part of the defence position. And there's such a terrific battle going on there. Well, anyway, the night went over once again. And my company was ordered to move up. We had to carry as much water as possible, as much ammunition as possible. Now, we were all issued many, many, well, a long time previously, with a chadwal. A chadwal is a canvas type of water bottle. It's about six inches wide. It contains 2 1/4 or 2 1/2 pints of water, and it narrows at the neck, and there's a tie string near the neck which you tie on, and you can also hook it over your bayonet or hang it on your equipment. Well, when you first put water in there, the water runs out just like a sieve, and at such a time the canvas gets wet, so the best thing is to wet it first and then put the water in. We were ordered to take the chadwals of water in for the wounded because they were in a bad state for the want of water. By now, these places have been surrounded and are using airdrops to supply them, with the American Dakotas dropping supplies to them by parachute. And I can't say too much about it, but I've heard so much, but I don't want to condemn people, but the Dakotas by the Americans are dropping the stuff too high, and it's dropping into Japanese positions. And it was also, a lot was hanging on the trees. You could see all the white parachutes hanging on the trees with their goods hanging down below, which the Japanese shot up, so they were useless. So they were in bad state of surgical equipment and also water. Every man had to carry water in and as much ammunition as he can.
So the picture was that as the relieving units went in, the Indians and then the Royal Barks, the Japanese would cut it off again after
yes.
they'd gone in.
So it was every night it was cut off. It remained cut off for some time. So we went in again, we opened the road and went in. And as we walked into Kohima, the smell of decomposing bodies, the smell of death and devastation. Well, it was just a battlefield. We were now used with a sweet, sickly smell of decomposing bodies. We climbed up the hill, which was quite a heavy climb, 4,000 feet, with all our own equipment, with our additional grenades, additional ammunition, additional water. Not that we minded. We were going there with a purpose to let the Royal West Kents out. They hadn't got out yet. We went up this hill and we passed a part which was a bit flat on our left-hand side. It seemed to run down into this valley that I spoke about on the left. All the way along, we were skirting this road, looking down in the valley and the high hills on our right. So they built this road on the hillsides with their bulldozers and scoops. Good job they'd made of it. And down the valley, the deep valley. Well, this seemed to be a sort of re-entrant, a smaller re-entrant into the valley. And in there, there was a supply of water. The only supply of water in Kohima area. And they were so desperate for water for the wounded that people had gone there and the Japs had it covered for. And there was a lot of sniping and a lot of decomposing bodies done there. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of Japanese there. They done an attack in there, tried to take it over. And our men defeat them. So you have the smell of death, you have the dead bodies, you have the devastation of air supplies, all the stuff, parachutes and everything, intermingled wherever you went, broken rifles, broken equipment, disbanded equipment. We went up right forward onto the top of the hill, and we got the men down undercover. Undercover was just below the cover of the hill, while the company commander went and had a chat with the Royal West Kents to see what was happening, see where we had to go. And quickly we took over the Royal West Kents positions, which is right forward in opposite some Japanese bunkers. The four platoons quickly got into these positions, and then Company HQ moved in, and we took over from the Royal West Kents. I described in small detail. My words is quite insufficient to describe the state of these poor people. You had to see them. Of the people who are now letting out this thing, eyes red, shocked, white, some of them, with the wounds that they had, simple wounds, untreated wounds, the smell of them, the complete disheveled state they were in, all the broken rifles lying, all the rifles lying around the side, the top of the hill, obviously with their wounded just dropping and them not having time to collect them, all the parachutes. Some of the lads' uniforms were black with blood, and it was a pleasure to let them out. They went scurrying down the hill, and we had opened the road at this junction. We kept it open during the day, but it was under occasional sniper fire. And we saw these lads moving out, and we felt like cheering them. But we were in this No, in their position. They had dug deep foxholes that hold two or three or four men. They were on constant attack, as you know, as I've explained, and everyone knows about Kohima, I think they do anyway. They were under constant bombardment and shell fire and splinters and all this, that they had dug themselves in the ground and put splinter proofing over the top of the deep holes. With a constant shelling, a constant movement of the ground, the earth, the sandy element of the area, these people had made themselves comfortable by lining the top of the shelter and the sides of the shelter with parachutes, because this constant pouring down of soil and sand on top of them would also dirty weapons. So we took over these positions. My company went forward and took over a position with which they had used their company HQ. In short, it was just a slit trench with a place where we could stand and look out over the top. And further down on the right was a deep trench, left was another deep trench. One contained the signalers and one contained the company runners, platoon runners, and a company runner. Company runner was the lad who run back and forth to battalion HQ with messages if the event of anything going wrong with the wirelesses. And the platoon runners were lads who took their messages to their platoons. Sometimes they'd be with us, sometimes they wouldn't. We took over this position, and the company commander was scurrying around, going around the platoons. I'd been around the platoons, seeing what ammunition they wanted, how they were situated. But the company commander wanted me to stay with the set as much as possible while he'd done his reconnaissance and got everybody settled in. The company commander came in late at night. We discarded all our water. It was all taken off us on our arrival in there, including half of our water bottle was also taken off us. So all our water, we had a half a water bottle and forbidden to touch it. Not like the Americans who just swig theirs under the units, they swig theirs. Water was under very strict control in the British Army. You weren't allowed to touch it unless you were ordered. You were given instructions that you could. We dispensed with a lot of the ammunition too. So now we were settled into this defensive position, waiting to see what would happen. Major Stock came back and he said, "Oh, Sergeant Major, there's got to be an attack next morning on these bunkers in front of us." Now, I'm quite sure that Major Stock said, "D Company is doubling up with us. We are going to do the attack. When we move off, D Company are doubling up with us so that there's two of D Company in these positions. When we move out, they are in position in case the attack fails." Now, the story has it that D Company had to do the attack. Well, I strongly opposed that suggestion. This is what somebody's wrote up after the whole thing incident happened. C Company, who was the first company they had to do the attack on these positions. And then D Company would take over all our positions and hold them whilst we were in front of the attack. We're expecting severe casualties because we're running against Japanese bunkers, as I've explained before. There were some loose Japanese hanging around in trenches, but the intention was to have a go at them, to clear the hill. The Div commander was driving for to get the hill cleared.
What were the Japanese positions like, and how far away were they? What was the ground between you?
Well, the ground between us, I'd say from the bunker position that we could see, was only about, from the front platoons, about 20 yards, no more. It was just a mound stuck on top of the hill. And I've explained their system of bunkers. They could go in there and put trees in and make a really strong bunker on top of this hill. I forget the names. I think they called them monkey positions. The monkey was M, was the, and their code name was monkey. It was a phonetic alphabet, in other words, monkey positions. I wasn't there long enough to get know too much about it. I'll explain in a short while. Now, all plans were made for an attack next morning. My company commander doubled up with D Company officer further back, Tanky Waterhouse, Major Tanky Waterhouse, who was a national serviceman, who'd risen to major. Very, very good man. Everyone liked him. He was command D Company, and him and Roger Stock were great friends. Well, Major Stock went back to have a chat with him and talked to him about what was happening, what was going to happen. And he came back to me. He says, look, Sarmage, he says, I want to be alert for next morning. He says, for the attack. He says, I want you to do the first 4 hours on stag. Stag means you're on control with the wireless set. You've got this, that, and the other. And he went back and slept with in the major's bunk. And all sorts, doubling up. He was away from the command post. I was in charge of the command post with the signals and the runners. We knew where to get the company commander if he should be required. And so the setup was that we are now in position. The platoon's distributed for an attack. The platoon's ready to receive any attack coming at them. And all things set for a movement into the Japs the next morning. The company commander said he wanted 4 hours good rest so that he was alert. Short late nights, you know, short dark nights, let's say. He was going to come in so that he was in plenty of time for the attack. Now, you've got to consider the state of the men. Tiredness. We'd worked hard from early morning, late at night. We'd carried this ammunition up, would help to dig the holes, we'd been working the whole of the time. Everyone was tired. Everybody wanted to get the head down. So once they get the head down, head down means getting down to sleep. Everyone is out for the count, until they're aroused again. Well, also, the system was, you do 2 hours on and 2 hours off. 2 hours on, double sentries on post, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. And we got used with this. But the men, all this lack of sleep overnight and working during the day made them, you know, awakened them in a way. But we were pretty fresh troops, you know, compared to them were just relieved. But this was a system that they had to get used with for the rest of the battle they were involved with. Two on, two off. Well, the major asked me to do the 4 hours on, which willingly I do, and I stood there. The signallers were sleeping down below, and the runners, and I was standing there on my own. Just one signaller was awake, by the way. One had to remain awake for the set. Nothing happened during the night until Major Stock came up to us. He says, right, O Sarmage, get yourself back and get some sleep. He said, I'm all right now. He said, normally, we would have had to send a runner to rouse him. But he's so tensed up, maybe, you know, ready for the go, that he was ready and he came and took over from me. Roger Stock, the runners and the signallers, sadly. I went back to double up with the acting sergeant major of D Company, Sergeant McCartney, and he had a deep shelter. And there was two well-made beds in them, places for to sleep. Grooves, you see, they used to go down the ground straight, and then they used to billow out at the bottom just like a submarine, so that the men could sleep under the shelter of the earth. And if you had to stand, you could still stand and shoot at the ends, but they were billowed out so that people could sleep and out of the way of the people standing. I went in one of these places, and no sooner had I put my head down to sleep than I was away. Now, we had a drill from Arakan system. If you went to sleep, you went to sleep fully clothed, fully dressed, fully equipment on, the whole lot. You'd take your helmet off only, and you'd wrap the rifle sling or your weapon sling around your wrist. So if you had to get out in a hurry, you were there with all your fighting equipment. It was an essential drill, by the way. You couldn't jump out and then suddenly found you had left your rifles or whatever behind you. It was an essential drill, and a good drill. I went sound asleep, and then I was woke by a sudden explosion, a terrific explosion. And, well, I don't think I was woke, I was still half asleep. And I'm hearing a voice shouting, Sarmage McLean, Sarmage McLean, waking your bloody cell up. And I woke up, and the trench had been hit by a shell, most likely a phosphorus shell, because green phosphorus is pouring into one end of the trench and setting the parachutes afire. And, of course, dived out. And he was already out shouting down to me. And he vanished. I was out and I was covered in green phosphorus. Green phosphorus is the inside of a bomb which creates smoke. And it's a stuff once exposed to the air burns. And it gives off smoke and it also gives off deep penetrating burns. Well, I was covered in this on me battle dress, and being a 3-inch mortar man, I knew I had to get it off as quickly because we were well trained in phosphorus with our smoke shells for the 3-inch mortars. I remember, in the first instance, I told you I'd been on a 3-inch mortar course and was a 3-inch mortar man. So I knelt down in the sand and I was scrubbing the sand. It was all pulverized earth, rubbing the stuff off me as fast as I could. It was on my hands and all over us. And then the Japs, just at that crucial moment, the Japs came in yelling and shouting in the attack. Instead of us attacking them, they mustn't have read our rule book. They cheated. They attacked us. And they caught everybody, not with their trousers down, but we were, some were sleeping, some were not. I don't know what happened, but there was such a battle went on in my company area and D company area that I was sort of half shocked with the third of this explosion, which reawakened me head noises. I'm not going to harp on too much about this because people think that this shell shock business was a farce, but I don't think so now. I was suffering with these head noises by the sudden explosion, and I knew that anything happened to me, I'd be done when I was lying down, and I was lying down when it happened. I knew if I stood up, I'd never be hit. I told you that in the first instance. I'd never be hit. I'd had a feeling. And it's sure enough, I was sleeping and I got hit. The Japs were in among us, and just about 10 yards away was a Japanese standing there, sergeant. You could see him, sergeant, with his stripes on. A fearsome-looking man, waving a sword and brandishing a sword, waving it round. They were very good with the sword, you know. They were inherited from the relatives, and they used to practice as Bushiro, you know, with swords and what have you. And he'd stand waving his swords and shouting and yelling. Now, when I think of this later on, he was drawing attention for people to fire at him, while his other men waited at the Bren guns opening up, and they'd throw grenades at the Bren guns, which was happening. They flung grenades at any Bren gun that opened up, and they were hitting our lads. Now, at this instance, I jumped off the ground when I saw the sergeant. I said, I'm going to get that basket. And up with my Sten gun, and took it, didn't take aim, I just put it up and bang, the gun wouldn't fire. I was speechless. I was furious. I went berserk. Again, a weapon failed us. I quickly pulled the bolt back, hit the magazine, a sharp hit, aimed and fired again. The gun wouldn't fire again. I was distraught then. I was cursing the gun, cursing everybody. It could only happen to McLean this. Out, off with the magazine, put another one on. Same thing happened. The Bren gun would not fire. The Sten gun would not fire. And no matter how I tried, in those few seconds, few minutes, and I was very apt, with very good at weapons, I couldn't get this gun to fire. No way. I'd just get in a clunk, as if something was jamming inside. When you took the magazine off, you could see the round had been dragged forward, but it was slumped across the opening of the magazine. It wasn't being driven forward properly. So I took a grenade out with the intention of hitting this chap with a grenade. I had the pin out, and I was determined to get him, because he was causing all the disturbance in the area. And I was ready to fling it, and I said, I cannot. All round this area is our lads in positions, these little foxholes, which were scattered quite uneven in the top of the hill. I said, I'm most likely to hit them. So I go down, and I put the pin back in the grenade and bent the pin back so it wouldn't fall out. And somebody in the meantime had hit the Jap sergeant, got him down. So I said, this is the moment to try to get the phosphorus off my hands. My hands were burning, and they were getting painful, and I was rubbing sand on. That was one of them. It looked ghastly when it happened, and here and there. But that was nothing to what some of the lads were getting, but their phosphorus was very painful. Now, let's just look at this battle that I'm trying to describe. The hill had been enshrouded with parachutes. Some great person with a British soldier's meticulous mind for cleanliness and orderliness. Some say it was the general, Major General Grover. Some said it was a brigadier who came along and said, get this ruddy place tied up. Get these parachutes off this hill. Shift them. The parachutes up on the trees, we couldn't get down, but there's lots of parachutes in the area and rubbish. Get these parachutes shifted. And they took them down the back of the hill. And there was a lot of them. Now, the snipers were busy, so we were risking our lives getting these parachutes away and chance of being hit, but we had to obey the order. They were shifted and put in a heap at the back, just down past where our officers were operating on the wounded, not our officers, where the Royal West Kents were in a deep square hole in the ground with the tarpaulins over the top with lanterns in and mock-up beds or places for the stretchers to lie, and all amputating and doing their operations and everything in here under the most awkward circumstances. Well, I'll come back to the parachutes. Someone...
That was the day before, when you first arrived, you'd done the time.
This is the early morning after we arrived. In other words, we hardly got into the place when the Japs attacked. Now, this is Emperor Tojo's birthday, and they intended to take Kohima with an all-out assault on this occasion. The one just driving us, the Royal Berks, was in a right meddy fight. We were having a fight. The whole front was up in a uproar of a battle. Not that we knew what was happening. We're just interested in our own area. Now, behind us was one of these phosphorus shells or bombs or whatever it was that they had landed in the back of these parachutes. Now, somebody said it was an ammunition dump fire. I don't believe them. There's no ammunition dump down there that I knew of, because it would have been pinpointed to me. And as far as the battalion ammunition point was concerned, would be back with the RSM at Lancaster Gate, miles away from us. But this thing dropped among the parachutes, and I swear it was the parachutes. Now, we are fighting a battle on top of a hill. We were defending. The Japs are coming in towards us. We are silhouetted on top of this hill with this light of the burn and the flames from these burning parachutes, which was quite intensive, because they were dry, you know, with the heats and everything. They were burning merrily, and we were stuck out like sore thumbs on top of the hill to the advancing Japs. Anyway, our lads fought so very well that they held the Japs. They drove them back. Whistles blew and the Japs vanished, leaving a lot of dead Japs. We won the day. Of course, we had doubled up with D Company, as I said, and D Company were very active, and the shoot-up as well, so the Japs had actually hit two companies. But then came the sad news of all the deaths and all the have you. My company commander, the runners and the signalers were all dead. A shell had landed right into the shell hole, into the position where they were, Roger Stocks. And all dead. I went to see them. There's nothing you could do. They're just mangled pulps of body. And I went back to try to... This is how dazed I was. I was trying to dig out Sergeant McCartney from the shell hole that had burned and collapsed. And I was trying to dig him out there when Tanky Waterhouse, Major Waterhouse, says, "What are you doing there, Sergeant Major?" I said, "I'm trying to get Sergeant McCartney out, the body." He says, "Forget it, Sergeant McCartney's out." And so he says, "Get yourself back, Sergeant Major, get your wounds attended to." I said, "I'm all right." My clothes were in shatters with burns. My legs had been caught on with this phosphorus. My hands were turned black and swollen. I'd say I was a bit shell-shocked as well. Let's put it this way. I say I was shell-shocked. So I went back to the field dressing station, and there's hordes of people lying out in the open. Wounded people. People dying. People all over the shop. Now, I hadn't realised this. I'd just been taken over and sat down. And somebody... A sergeant, I remember a sergeant and you, and we all worked together. Our own field ambulance was now up in the front looking after these wounded, and our own doctors. They got the Royal West Kent's doctors out. Now we had our own in. And this sergeant came along, like part of their job, looking after the wounded, a cup of sweet tea. That's where all the water went. And I got a cup of sweet tea and got it down as, well, it's a great recovery as this. We had no tea. We had nothing to eat. And I start looking around us and say, "What am I doing here? Look at all these poor lads, wounded, dead, limbs missing. There's an officer of the Royal Berks lying beside us, obviously dying." And the place was just littered with them. It's hard to say, about 20 square yards, all stretchers and wounded and dying and bleeding people and mourning people. As I said once before, don't think that a man lies and just bites like the cowboy and dies in the dust. They moan and they groan and they cry for their mothers, especially the younger ones. I recovered with this tea, and I said, "Well, I'm not stopping here," and I went back to the company position. And I was wandering around having a look at the men in the forward position, see what happened, learning of all the deaths. And then Major Waterhouse got his hands again. He says, "Sir, Major, I told you to get out of it." Use strong language this time. "Bloody well get out of it." He says, "You've done your work. Out you go." So back I had to go to the ambulance station and they dressed us and they gave us an evacuation chitty.